Chapter 4. Monday's Prisoner Rebellion. It is time for more rule learning and morning exercise before breakfast can be served. Vandy takes command. Okay, we're going to teach you these rules until you have all of them memorized. His energy is contagious, stimulating Saros to walk up and down the line of prisoners, brandishing his billy club. Quickly losing patience, Saros yells, "Come on, come on!" when the prisoners do not repeat the rules fast enough. Saros smacks his club against his open palm, making the whap-whap sound of restrained aggression. Vandy goes through toilet instructions for several minutes and repeats them many times until the prisoners meet his standards, repeating what he has told them about how they will use the facilities, for how long, and in silence. 819 thinks it's funny. Maybe we'll have something special for 819. Guard Varnish stands off to the side, not doing much at all. Saros and Vandy switch roles. Prisoner 819 continues to smile and even laugh at the absurdity of it all. "It's not funny, 819. Throughout, Guard Marcus alternates with Saros in reading the rules. Saros: "Louder on that one. Prisoners must report all rule violations to the guards." Prisoners are made to sing the rules, and after so many repetitions, they have obviously learned all of them. Next come instructions regarding proper military-style upkeep of their cots. "From now on, your towels will be rolled up and placed neatly at the foot of your beds. Neatly, not thrown around. Got that?" says Vandy. Prisoner 819 starts acting up. He quits the exercises and refuses to continue. The others also stop until their buddy rejoins them. The guard asks him to continue, which he does for the sake of his comrades. "Nice touch, 819. Now take a seat in the hole," orders Vandy. 819 goes into solitary, but with a defiant swagger. As he methodically paces up and down the corridor in front of the prisoners, the tall guard, Carl Vandy, is beginning to like the feeling of dominance. "Okay, what kind of day is this?" mumbled responses. "Louder! Are you all happy?"
"Yes, Mr. Correctional Officer."
Varnish, trying to get into the act and be cool, asks,
"Are we all happy? I didn't hear the two of you."
"Yes, Mr. Correctional Officer."
4325, what kind of day is this?"
"It's a good day, Mr. Correctional Officer."
"No, it's a wonderful day."
"Yes, Mr. Correctional Officer."
They begin to chant.
"It's a wonderful day, Mr. Correctional Officer." 4325, what kind of day is it?"
"It's a good day."
Vandy:
"Wrong. It's a wonderful day."
"Yes, sir. It's a wonderful day."
"And you, 1037?
1037 gives his response a peppy, sarcastic intonation.
"It's a wonderful day."
Vandy:
"I think you'll do. Okay, return to your cells and have them neat and orderly in 3 minutes. Then stand by the foot of your bed."
He gives instructions to Varnish about how to inspect the cells. 3 minutes later, the guards enter the individual cells while the prisoners stand by their beds in military inspection style. Rebellion begins brewing. There's no question that the prisoners are getting frustrated by having to deal with what the guards are doing to them. Moreover, they are hungry and still tired from lack of a sound night's rest. However, they are going along with the show and are doing a pretty good job of making their beds, but not good enough for Vandy.
"You call that neat, 8612? It's a mess. Remake it right."
With that, he rips off the blanket and sheets and throws them on the floor. 8612 reflexively lunges at him, screaming,
"You can't do that. I just made it."
Caught off guard, Vandy pushes the prisoner off and hits him in the chest with his fist as he yells out for reinforcements.
"Guards, emergency in cell 2.
All the guards surround 8612 and roughly throw him into the hole, where he joins 819, who has been sitting there quietly. Our rebels begin to plot a revolution in the dark, tight confines.
but they miss the chance to go to the toilet, to which the others are escorted in pairs. It soon becomes painful to hold in the urge to urinate, so they decide not to make trouble just yet, but soon. Interestingly, Guard Saros later told us that it was difficult to maintain the guard persona when he was alone with a prisoner, going to, in, or from the toilet, because there were not the external physical props of the prison setting on which to rely. He and most of the other guards reported that they acted tougher and were more demanding on those prisoner toilet runs in order to counter their tendency to ease up when off-site. It was just harder to act the tough guard role when alone with a solitary prisoner, one-on-one. There was also a sense of shame in grown-ups like them being reduced to toilet patrol. The rebel duo occupying the hole also misses breakfast, which is served promptly at 8 a.m., al fresco in the open yard. Some eat sitting on the floor, while others stand. They violate the no-talking rule by talking and discussing a hunger strike to show prisoner solidarity. They also agree that they should start to demand a lot of things to test their power, like getting their eyeglasses, meds, and books back, and not doing the exercises. Previously silent prisoners, including 3401, our only Asian-American participant, now become energized in their open support. After breakfast, 7258 and 5486 test the plan by refusing orders to return to their cells. This forces the three guards to push them into their respective cells. Ordinarily, such disobedience would have earned them hole time, but the hole is already overcrowded, two people being its physical limit. In the rising cacophony, I'm amazed to hear prisoners from cell 3 volunteer to clean the dishes. This gesture is in line with the generally cooperative stance of cellmate Tom, 2093, but is at odds with their buddies, who are in the process of planning rebellion. Maybe they were hoping to cool the mark, to ease the rising tensions. With the curious exception of those in cell 3, the prisoners are careening out of control. The morning shift guard trio decides that the prisoners must consider the guards too lax, which is encouraging this mischief. They decide it is time to stiffen up. First, they institute a morning work period, which today means scrubbing down the walls and floors. Then, in the first stroke of their collective, creative revenge, they take the blankets off the prisoners' beds in cells 1 and 2, carry them outside the building, and drag them through the underbrush until the blankets are covered with stickers and burrs. Unless prisoners don't mind being stuck by these sharp pins, they must spend an hour or more picking out each of them if they want to use their blankets. Prisoner 5704 goes ballistic, screaming at the senseless stupidity of this chore. But that is exactly the point. Senseless, mindless, arbitrary tasks are the necessary components of guard power. The guards want to punish the rebels and also to induce unquestioning conformity. After initially refusing, 5704 reconsiders when he thinks it will get him on the good side of Guard Saros and gain him a cigarette, so he starts picking and picking out the hundreds of stickers in his blanket. The chore was all about order, control, and power. Who had it, and who wanted it? Guard Saros asks, "Nothing but the best in this prison, wouldn't you all agree?" Prisoners mutter various sounds of approval. "Really fine, Mr. Correctional Officer," replies someone in cell 3. Nevertheless, 8612, just released from solitary back to cell 2, has a somewhat different answer. "Oh, fuck you, Mr. Correctional Officer." 8612 is ordered to shut his filthy mouth. I realize that this is the first obscenity that has been uttered in this setting. I had expected the guards to curse a lot as part of establishing the macho role, but they have not yet done so. However, Doug, 8612, does not hesitate to fling obscenities around. Guard Saros. "It was weird to be in command. I felt like shouting that everyone was the same. Instead, I made prisoners shout at each other, 'You guys are a bunch of assholes.' I was in disbelief when they recited it over and over upon my command." Vandy added, "I found myself taking on the guard role. I didn't apologize for it. In fact, I became quite a bit bossier. The prisoners were getting quite rebellious, and I wanted to punish them for breaking up our system. The next sign of rebellion comes from a small group of prisoners, Stu, 819, and Paul, 5704, and for the first time, 7258, the previously docile hubby. Tearing the ID numbers from the front of their uniforms, they protest loudly against the unacceptable living conditions. The guards immediately retaliate by stripping each of them stark naked until their numbers are replaced. The guards retreat to their quarters with an uneasy sense of superiority, but an eerie silence falls over the yard as they eagerly await the end of their much too long first shift on this job. Welcome to the Rebellion, Day Shift. When the day shift arrives and suits up before their 10 a.m. duty, they discover that all is not as under control as it was when they left yesterday. The prisoners in Cell 1 have barricaded themselves in. They refuse to come out. Guard Arnett immediately takes over and requests the morning shift to stay on until this matter is resolved. His tone implies that they are somehow responsible for letting things get out of hand. The ringleader of the revolt is Paul, 5704, who got his buddies in Cell 1, Hubby, 7258, and Glenn, 3401, to agree that it was time to react against the violation of the original contract they made with the authorities, me. They push their beds against the cell door, cover the door opening with blankets, and shut off the lights. Unable to push the door open, the guards vent their anger on Cell 2, which is filled with the usual top-of-the-line troublemakers, Doug, 8612, Stu, 819, veterans of the whole, and Rich, 1037. In a surprise counterattack, the guards rush in, grab the three cots, and haul them out into the yard, while 8612 struggles furiously to resist. They are pushing and shoving and shouting all around that cell, spilling out into the yard. Up against the wall! Give me the handcuffs! Get everything! Take everything! 819 screams wildly. No, no, no! This is an experiment! Leave me alone! Shit, let go of me, fucker! You're not gonna take our fucking beds! 8612. A fucking simulation! It's a fucking simulated experiment! It's no prison! And fuck Dr. Embargo! Arnett, in a remarkably calm voice, intones, When the prisoners in Cell 1 start behaving properly, your beds will be returned. You can use whatever influence you can on them to make them behave properly. A calmer-sounding prisoner's voice importunes the guards, These are our beds. You should not take them away. In utter bewilderment, the naked prisoner 8612 says in a plaintive voice, They took our clothes, and they took our beds. This is unbelievable. They took our clothes, and they took our beds. He adds, They don't do that in real prisons. Curiously, another prisoner calls back, They do. The guards burst into laughter. 8612 thrusts his hands between the cell door bars, open palms facing upward in a pleading gesture, an unbelieving expression on his face, and a new, strange tone to his voice. Guard Jay Landry tells him to get his hands off the door, but Saros is more direct and smacks his club against the bars. 8612 pulls his hands back just in time to avoid his fingers being smashed. The guards laugh. Now the guards move toward Cell 3, as 8612 and 1037 call out to their Cell 3 comrades to barricade themselves in. Get your beds in front of the door. One horizontal and one vertical. Don't let them in. They'll take your beds. They've taken our beds. Oh, shit. 1037 goes over the top with his call to violent resistance. Fight them. Resist violently. The time has come for violent revolution. Guard Landry returns armed with a big fire extinguisher and shoots bursts of skin-chilling carbon dioxide into Cell 2, forcing the prisoners to flee backward. Shut up, and stay away from the door. Ironically, this is the same extinguisher that the Human Subjects Research Committee insisted we have available in case of an emergency. But as the beds are pulled from Cell 3 into the corridor, the rebels in Cell 2 feel betrayed.
Cell 3, what's going on? We told you to barricade the doors.
What kind of solidarity is that? Was it the sergeant?
Sergeant,
2093.
If it was your fault, that's all right, because we all understand that you're impossible.
But hey, Cell 1, keep your beds like that. Don't let them in.
The guards realize that 6 of them can subdue a prisoner rebellion this time, but in the future they will have to get by with only 3 guards against the 9 prisoners, and that could add up to trouble. Never mind. Arnett formulates the divide-and-conquer psychological tactic of making Cell 3 the privileged cell, and gives its members the special privileges of washing, brushing their teeth, beds and bedding returned, and water turned on in their cell. Guard Arnett loudly announces that because Cell 3 has been behaving well, their beds are not being torn up. They will be returned when order is restored in Cell 1.
The guards are trying to solicit the good prisoners to persuade the others to behave properly.
Well, if we knew what was wrong, we could tell them,
one of the good prisoners exclaims.
Vandy replies, you don't need to know what's wrong. You can just tell them to straighten up.
8612 yells out,
Cell 1, we're with you, all 3 of us.
Then he makes a vague threat to the guards as they cart him off back to solitary wearing only a towel.
The unfortunate thing is, you guys think we've played all our cards.
That job done, the guards take a brief time out for a smoke and to formulate a plan of action to deal with the Cell 1 barricade. When Rich, 1037, refuses to come out of Cell 2, 3 guards manhandle him, throw him to the ground, handcuff his ankles, and drag him by his feet out into the yard. He and Rebel 8612 yell back and forth from the hold to the yard about their condition, pleading with the full prisoner contingent to sustain the rebellion. Some guards are trying to make space in the hall closet for another place in an expanded hole in which to deposit 1037. While they move boxes around to free up some more room, they drag him back into a cell along the floor with his feet still chained together. Guards Arnett and Landy confer and agree on a simple way to bring some order to this bedlam. Start the count. The count confers order on chaos. Even with only 4 prisoners in line, all at attention, the guards begin by making the prisoners call out their numbers.
My number is 4325, Mr. Correctional Officer. My number is 2093, Mr. Correctional Officer.
The count sounds out up and down the line, consisting of the 3 goodies from Cell 3 and 7258, naked with only a towel around his waist. Remarkably, 8612 calls out his number from the hole, but in mocking fashion. The guards now drag 1037 into solitary by the feet, putting him in a far corner of the hall closet that has become a makeshift second hole. Meanwhile, 8612 continues yelling for the prison superintendent.
Hey, Zimbardo, get your ass over here!
I decide not to intervene at this point, but to watch the confrontation and the attempts to restore law and order. Some interesting comments are recorded in the retrospective diaries of the prisoners, completed after the study had ended. Paul, 5704, talks about the first effects of the time distortion that is beginning to alter everyone's thinking. After we had barricaded ourselves in this morning, I fell asleep for a while, still exhausted from lack of a full sleep last night. When I awoke, I thought it was the next morning, but it wasn't even lunch today yet. He fell asleep again in the afternoon, thinking it was night when he awoke, but it was only 5 p.m. Time distortion also got to 3401, who felt starved and was angry that dinner had not been served, thinking it was 9 or 10 p.m. when it was not yet 5 p.m. Although the guards eventually crushed the rebellion and used it as justification for escalating their dominance and control over these now potentially dangerous prisoners, many of the prisoners felt good about having had the courage to challenge the system. 5486 remarked that his
spirits were good, guys together, ready to raise hell. We staged the jockstrap rebellion.
No more jokes, no jumping jacks, no playing with our heads.
He added that he was limited by what his cellmates in the good cell would agree to back him up on. Had he been in cell 1 or 2, he would have done as they did and rebelled more violently. Our smallest, most physically fragile prisoner, Glenn, 3401, the Asian-American student, seemed to have had an epiphany during the rebellion.
I suggested moving the beds against the door to keep the guards out. Although I'm usually quiet, I don't like being pushed around like this. Having helped organize and participate in our rebellion was important for me. I built my ego from there. I felt it was the best thing in my entire experience. Sort of asserting myself after the barricade made me more known to myself.
After lunch, maybe an escape. With cell 1 still barricaded and some rebels in solitary, lunch is set for only a few. The guards have prepared a special lunch for good cell 3 for them to eat in front of their less well-behaved fellows. Surprising us again, they refuse the meal. The guards try to persuade them just to taste the delicious meal, but even though they are hungry after their minimal oatmeal breakfast and last night's slim dinner, the cell 3 inmates cannot agree to act as such traitors, as rat finks. A strange silence pervades the yard for the next hour. However, these cell 3 men are totally cooperative during the work period chores, some of which include taking more stickers out of their blankets. Prisoner Rich, 1037, is offered a chance to leave solitary and join the work brigade, but refuses. He is coming to prefer the relative quiet in the dark. The rules say only 1 hour max in the hole, but that max is being stretched to 2 hours now for 1037 and also for occupant 8612. Meanwhile, in cell 1, two prisoners are quietly executing the first stage of their new escape plan. Paul, 5704, will use his long fingernails, strengthened from guitar picking, to loosen the screws in the faceplate of the power outlet. Once that is accomplished, they plan to use the edge of the plate as a screwdriver to unscrew the cell door lock. One will pretend to be sick, and when the guard is taking him to the toilet, will open the main entrance door down the hall. Signaled by a whistle, the other cellmate will burst out. They will knock the guard down and run away to freedom. As in real prisons, prisoners can show remarkable creativity in fashioning weapons out of virtually anything and hatching ingenious escape plans. Time and oppression are the fathers of rebellious invention. But as bad luck would have it, guard John Landry, making routine rounds, turns the door handle on cell 1, and it falls out to the ground with a resounding thud. Panic ensues.
"Help!" Landry screams out. "Escape!"
Arnett and Marcus rush in, block the door, and then get handcuffs to chain the would-be escapees together on the floor of their cell. Of course, 8612 was one of the troublemakers, so he gets his frequent flyer trip back into the hole. A nice count to calm the restless masses. Several anxious hours have passed since the day shift reported for work. It is time to soothe the savage beasts before further trouble erupts.
Good behavior is rewarded, and bad behavior is not rewarded.
That calm, commanding voice is now clearly identified as Arnett's. He and Landry once again join forces to line up their charges for another count. Arnett takes charge. He has emerged as the leader of the day shift.
Hands against the wall, on this wall here. Now let's see how well everyone is learning his numbers. As before, sound your number, starting at this end.
Sarge starts it off, setting the tone of a fast, loud response, which the other prisoners pick up with some variations. 4325 and 7258 are fast and obedient. We have not heard much from Jim, 4325, a big, robust six-footer who could be a lot to handle if he decided to get physical with the guards. In contrast, Glenn, 3401, and Stu, 819, are always slower, evidently reluctant to comply mindlessly. Not satisfied and imposing his own brand of control,
Arnett makes them count in creative ways. They do it by threes, backward, any way he can devise that will make it unnecessarily difficult. Arnett is also demonstrating his creativity to all onlookers, as does Guard Hellman, but Arnett doesn't seem to take nearly as much personal pleasure in his performance as the other shift leader does. For him, this is more a job, to be done efficiently. Landry suggests having the prisoners sing their numbers. Arnett asks, "Was that popular last night? Did people like singing?" Landry, "I thought they liked it last night." But a few prisoners respond that they don't like to sing. Arnett, "Oh well, you must learn to do things you don't like. It's part of reintegrating into regular society." 819 complains, "People out on the street don't have numbers." Arnett responds, "People out on the street don't have to have numbers. You have to have numbers because of your status here." Landry gives specific instructions about how to sing their scales. Sing up a scale like Do Re Mi. All of the prisoners conform and sing the ascending scale to the best of their ability, then the descending scale, except for 819, who doesn't attempt any scales. 819 can't sing for a damn. Let's hear it again. 819 starts to explain why he can't sing. Arnett, however, clarifies the purpose of this exercise. "I didn't ask you why you couldn't sing. The object is for you to learn to sing." Arnett criticizes the prisoners for their poor singing, but the weary prisoners just giggle and laugh when they make mistakes. In contrast to his shiftmates, guard John Marcus seems listless. He rarely gets involved in the main activities in the yard. Instead, he volunteers to do off-site chores, like picking up food at the college cafeteria. His body posture gives the impression that he is not enacting the macho guard image. He slouches, shoulders down, head drooping. I ask Warden Jaffe to talk to him about being more responsive to the job for which he is getting paid. The warden takes him off the yard into his office and chastises him. "The guards have to know that every guard has to be what we call a tough guard. The success of this experiment rides on the behavior of the guards to make it seem as realistic as possible." Marcus challenges him. "Real-life experience has taught me that tough, aggressive behavior is counterproductive." Jaffe gets defensive. He starts saying that the purpose of the experiment is not to reform prisoners, but to understand how prisons change people when they are faced with the situation of guards being all-powerful. "But we are also being affected by this situation. Just putting on this guard uniform is a pretty heavy thing for me." Jaffe becomes more reassuring. "I understand where you're coming from. We need you to act in a certain way. For the time being, we need you to play the role of tough guard. We need you to react as you imagine the pigs would. We're trying to set up the stereotype guard. Your individual style has been a little too soft." "Okay. I'll try to adjust somewhat." "Good. I knew we could count on you." Meanwhile, 8612 and 1037 remain in solitary. However, now they are yelling out complaints about violations of the rules. No one is paying attention. Each of them separately says he needs to see a doctor. 8612 says he is feeling ill, feeling strange. He mentions a weird sensation of his stocking cap still being on his head when he knows it is not there. His demand to see the warden will be granted later in the day. At 4 o'clock, beds are returned to Good Cell 3, as the guard's attention focuses on the prisoners in the still rebellious Cell 1. The night shift guards are asked to come in early, and together with the day shift, they storm the cell, shooting the fire extinguisher at the door opening to keep the prisoners at bay. They strip the three prisoners naked, take away their beds, and threaten to deprive them of dinner if they show any further disobedience. Already hungry from missing lunch, the prisoners melt into a sullen, quiet blob. The Stanford County Jail Prisoners' Grievance Committee. Realizing that the situation is becoming volatile, I have the warden announce over the loudspeaker that prisoners should elect 3 members to the newly formed Stanford County Jail Prisoners Grievance Committee, who will meet with Superintendent Zimbardo as soon as they agree on what grievances they want to have addressed and rectified. We later learned from a letter that Paul, 5704, sent to his girlfriend that he was proud to be nominated by his comrades to head this committee. This is a remarkable statement, showing how the prisoners had lost their broad time perspectives and were living in the moment. The grievance committee, consisting of elected members Paul, 5704, Jim, 4325, and Rich, 1037, tell me that their contract has been violated in many ways. Their prepared list includes that the guards are being both physically and verbally abusive. There is an unnecessary level of harassment. The food is not adequate. They want to have their books, glasses, and various pills and meds returned. They want more than one visiting night, and some of them want religious services. They argue that all of these conditions justified their need to rebel openly as they had all day long. Behind my silver reflecting sunglasses, I slip into the superintendent role automatically. I start out by saying I am sure we can resolve any disagreements amicably to our mutual satisfaction. I note that this grievance committee is a fine first step in that direction. I am willing to work directly with them as long as they represent the will of all the others. But you have to understand that a lot of the guards' hassling and physical actions have been induced by your bad behavior. You have brought it upon yourselves by disrupting our planned schedules and by creating panic among the guards, who are new to this line of work. They took away many of your privileges rather than becoming more physically abusive to the rebellious prisoners. The grievance committee members nod knowingly. I promise to take this grievance list to my staff tonight and to change as many negative conditions as possible and to institute some of the positive things you have suggested. I will bring a prison chaplain down tomorrow and have a second visiting night this week, for starters. That's great, thanks, says the head prisoner, Paul, 5704, and the others nod in agreement that progress is being made toward a more civil prison. We stand and shake hands, and they leave, pacified. I hope that they will tell their buddies to cool it from now on so we can avoid such confrontations. Prisoner 8612 begins a meltdown. Doug, 8612, is not in a cooperative mood. He is not buying the goodwill message of the grievance guys. More insubordination earns him more hold time, with his hands cuffed continuously. He says he is feeling sick and demands to see the warden. A while later, Warden Jaffe meets with him in his office and listens to the prisoner complain about the arbitrary and sadistic behavior of the guards. Jaffe tells him that his behavior is triggering the guards' reactions. If he would be more cooperative, Jaffe would see to it that the guards would lighten up on him. 8612 says that unless that happens soon, he wants out. Jaffe is also concerned about his medical complaints and asks if he wants to see a doctor, to which 8612 demurs for now. The prisoner is escorted back to his cell, from which he yells back and forth to Comrade Rich, 1037, who is still sitting in solitary, complaining about the intolerable conditions, and also wanting to see a doctor. Although seemingly comforted by his exchange with the warden, Prisoner 8612 goes off screaming in rage, insisting on seeing the fucking Dr. Zimbardo, superintendent. I agree to see him immediately. Our prison consultant mocks the mock prisoner. That afternoon I had arranged for the first visit to the prison of my consultant, Carlo Prescott, who had helped me design many of the features in the experiment to simulate a functional equivalent of imprisonment in a real jail. Carlo had recently been paroled from San Quentin State Prison after serving 17 years there, as well as time served at Folsom and Vacaville prisons, mostly for convictions on armed robbery felonies. I had met him a few months before during one of the course projects that my social psychology students organized
around the theme of individuals in institutional settings. Carlo had been invited by one of the students to give the class an insider's view of the realities of prison life. Carlo was only 4 months out of prison and filled with anger at the injustice of the prison system. He railed against American capitalism, racism, black Uncle Toms who do the man's work against brothers, warmongers, and much more. But he was remarkably perceptive and insightful about social interactions, as well as exceptionally eloquent, with a resonant baritone voice and seamless non-stop delivery. I was intrigued by this man's views, especially since we were about the same age, me 38, him 40, and both of us had grown up in an East or West Coast ghetto. But while I was going to college, Carlo was going to jail. We became fast friends. I became his confidant, patient listener to his extended monologues, psychological counselor, and booking agent for jobs and lectures. His first job was to co-teach with me a new summer school course at Stanford University on the psychology of imprisonment. Carlo not only told the class intimate details of his personal prison experiences, he arranged for other formerly incarcerated men and women to share theirs.